Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Football is many things. Unpredictable, exciting, colourful, passionate, absorbing, expensive.
Venal, infuriating, exasperating, time-consuming, depressing. But one thing it most certainly is not, is a level playing field.
Welcome to the famous sloping pitch. So the UK and Ireland have put in their favoured stadia for their 2028 Euros bid. They include Belfast's Casement Park and Everton's Bramley Moor Dock, neither of which have actually been built. The bid also suggests fans will be able to travel on the completed HS2 line or even swim to fixtures in Britain's pristine rivers. Other claims include entertainment from our raft of Eurovision winners, an England team captained by Dele Alli, Jam, both today and tomorrow, and bizarrely, the reunification of the monasteries. So, very, very confident.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it was interesting, the Euro 2028. Just the little snippets about it. Obviously, it's a long way off, and they could still give it to Turkey. But despite the UEFA's assurances that if the UK applied for it, then they'd be nodded through. But still, it's a bit of a slap in the chops for Old Trafford, isn't it? For old Trafford.
Yes.
Because, you know, remember when they were building the new Wembley? Old Trafford was like the default England stadium in that time. The second biggest capacity, the most prestigious, you know, in the rest of the country. They did go to St James's Park and Villa Park and other places, didn't they? But Old Trafford was like the one for the big games.
It's where the famous Greece game was, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. But it's just been it's 20 years of neglect by the Glazers have left it in a state that where it's no longer fit for purpose.
Yeah. And more of that later. Then we're going to talk about the Glazers.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Theatre of Dreams, they call it, don't they? That's the thing. But the dreams are the dreams of Winston Smith waking up screaming, "No, give it to her. Give my season ticket to her." There's just rats everywhere. But still. We'll come back to that.
Yeah. The other things, the history of football may be starting again.
Premier League,
if they get their own way and they have their own television channel, which God knows what that will look like, the Premier League television channel. Because like football before 1992, football under Sky will then have to be disappeared. And this will then invite the prospect of the first goal scorer of the Premier League TV era being also the record goal scorer in the history of football. And I just so hope it's an own goal, so that just briefly, own goal could be the record goal scorer.
Yeah, it was bad news for Brian Dean, then, isn't it?
Yes, it is bad news for Brian Dean, yeah. Was it a Friday night match that he scored in?
I think it was a Saturday lunchtime, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But, bad news for Alan Shearer, of course, because then the rest of his massive goal tally won't count anymore. Because he'd started, hadn't he, before the Premier League. Didn't he get 28 or 30 or something before for Southampton, before the Premier League rewrote history?
Yeah.
But still.
You've got to think the Premier League taking on the whole of a new broadcast arm is going to be a bad thing. I mean, they struggle to do the job that they're doing at the moment, don't they? Effectively, anyway.
Well, let's see. I mean, I would prioritise, if I was the Premier League, doing something about the 182 charges that they've levelled against Manchester City. But, you know, I'm not in charge of the Premier League, am I? Despite all the letters.
It would be very pleasing if you were. Now, you often get broadcasters who are much more responsible than us saying, don't try this at home. And last week, we were a little gung-ho, I feel. A little gung-ho in our joy when hearing of officials attacking players. And sure enough, this weekend, a referee's assistant linesman, Konstantin Hadzidakis, apparently elbowed Liverpool's Andy Robertson in the neck, and more of which almost immediately. Yeah. But please, good people, never ever do anything suggested on this podcast. That would be a very bad thing, apart from possibly applying to be head of the Premier League.
We very rarely offer tips for life, don't we? But yeah, I mean, last week, it occurred to me last week, we spoke not only about the Mexican referee kneeing the guy in the groin, which was absurd, but also the Harry Kane eyelash injury, as Sean Dyche referred to it. And it seemed like this week, those two stories combined and had a love child, didn't they? the Andy Robertson and Hatzidakis thing. Because the massive snowflakery of Robertson complaining about, because you couldn't see very much on the very distant footage where they'd drawn a little oval around it and tried to make it focus a little better to see what had happened. But it seemed pretty clear that Robertson grabbed the linesman by the arm, and the linesman was getting his arm free of that, and then Robertson's complaining, getting himself booked for dissent after that, for complaining about being, oh, he hit me in the neck or in the mouth or in the mouth region, you know, it seemed a massive snowflakery to me.
Well, yes, except in these days of, you know, offside, allowed to be somebody's breath. That was a big hit. And also, they always say, you know, you can never raise your arm, you know, in football. But a linesman, of course, that's his job. That's what he's there for. He's been waiting all week to raise his arm.
Yeah.
Of course he's going to raise his arm, isn't he?
Well, maybe he was just warming up for the second half, you know, just doing the things that he's going to be doing in the rest of the game.
Did you notice, though, he was incredibly pumped. That linesman.
Was
fit. He had like a skin tight outfit on and muscles bulging everywhere. And it felt a little bit like a steroid abuse thing. I have to say, I don't think you need to be that pumped to be a linesman.
Oh, well, maybe it hurt more than it appeared to.
It
was funny watching Robertson just half hiding behind his teammates and going, he hit me, the big bully. Anyway, so the linesman's being investigated, apparently, and has been stood down from officiating again this season while they investigate this far distant, out of focus footage of him raising his arm a bit. Yeah. And there have been various calls for him to be punished at least as much as Mitrovic for manhandling the referee, or for him not to be punished at all.
Yes, absolutely. Or he's been punished enough.
He's been punished enough was one thing, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, was it Keith Hackett who said that he could only assume that Konstantin Hatzidakis had reacted out of fear. You know, you see the muscles on that guy and the fear of Andy Robertson.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But you know, somebody coming up behind you.
It has been a way of, once again, highlighting the pressure that officials are put under, and whilst reiterating that they can't take matters into their own hands or indeed elbows.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of reaction about it, obviously. Not least the joy of Sky knowing that they had something to talk about during halftime, although it was a very, very good game. But there were two things. I mean, first of all, he's fast becoming my absolutely least favourite person in the world. Chris Sutton, who's this sort of, you know, paid controversialist, you know, agitprop, agent provocateur. In fact, he's so doggedly controversial that he's actually dull, to tell you the honest truth, because he's got a strong opinion on virtually everything.
Well, he was sitting all by himself, wasn't he, on the "we should go ahead even though they've suspended Lineker" bus. He was sitting all by himself on that one.
Yeah. But his phraseology I loved was to describe what the linesman did as he threw an elbow. You can't throw anything. Hold on a minute. He did not. He was hardly sort of Duncan Ferguson, was it? You know, it wasn't one of those. But the best bit was Roy Keane, who tell me what he said, Chris, because you know the lightning fall.
Well, no, I know. I'm only half remembering, but he said about Andy Robertson that I've seen this player for a long time in watching him. He's just a big baby.
I think he said it twice, which is very pleasing.
Baby.
I love that because it's such a childish term.
but it fit, didn't it? It fit.
It did. Oh yeah.
And it, in a way, it overshadowed a little bit the Arsenal Liverpool game itself, which was a brilliantly exciting game, actually, and Liverpool unexpectedly. Stirred into life. They were claiming, weren't they, that Liverpool were sort of stung into life, not by going two goals behind, but by Granit Xhaka having a go at Trent Alexander-Arnold. A little bit more snowflakery there. You can't square up. That'll just get Liverpool going. You can't. Yeah. Oh no! You've broken an unwritten rule of playing at Anfield. You have to be, you have to be really polite. Otherwise, the crowd will get on your case, and Liverpool will start playing. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, there was some truth in it, and it was quite interesting. Gary Neville saying that he'd not been picked because the Liverpool fans hated him so much that Alex Ferguson thought that gave them a better chance. He's just not on the pitch, but they get a narrative, don't they? And then they all cling to it. You know, this is now the truth. But Gary Neville, of course, you've seen recently, have you not? In the flesh.
Not to meet in person. Last week, after we recorded our show, I went to see a live show at the Wembley Arena of The Overlap, which is a YouTube sensation, apparently. And basically, the show was Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher and Roy Keane, as we were just speaking of, off of Sky TV in three big red armchairs, being prompted into their anecdotage by Kelly Cates and Josh Denzel off of Love Island. And the place was packed. There were like a handful of empty seats here and there, but the capacity is apparently 12,500.
And really?
I find it difficult to estimate crowds above about 5,000 because I don't usually have to. But it was in Wembley, in North London, so naturally it was mostly Manchester United fans. And it was really bizarre. They walked out like rock stars, you know, with a light show going on. And Gary Neville got cheers from the room. Jamie Carragher, cheers with a few boos mixed in here and there at the beginning. But then Roy Keane came out third, and absolutely the crowd just took the roof off at the sight of Roy Keane. It was astonishing. He's absolutely the star of the three of them. Absolutely incredibly popular and quite self-effacing about it as well. Quite sort of... subdued and a little smile playing on his face every time they cheered him, but that only makes him more popular. Because if Carragher gets a laugh line away, and he did, he got a couple of quite unpleasant laugh lines away. One about Gary Neville going somewhere with his uncle when he was a kid, and Jamie Carragher shouted out, "Yeah, your uncle's your dad."
Right, okay.
And you think, and then that sort of wolfish laughing at his own joke thing went. So, people tired of Jamie Carragher the longer it went on. But you see Roy Keane on the telly, and he's this mumbling, angry, opinionated, sort of randomly on and off bearded figure. And you think he must be Marmite to the football fan audience. You think, you know, maybe the United fans love him and other football fans are not quite so. But no, a football fan audience filling the Wembley Arena. He was the star. He was the star of the show. Yeah. I mean, I think it helps that when he speaks, he gets to the point and he delivers his thoughts in short sentences that are like punchlines that you can, and you can laugh at them or not. Like, you know, for example, Andy Robertson's a big baby. You know, you don't need any more than that. You know, you're already laughing at it, and then you can wait, and he can wait, and he's got the timing to wait and not do too much. Yeah. But Jamie Carragher, on the other hand, it seems able to speak for several minutes without any punctuation whatsoever, or drawing breath, and or thinking particularly. And it made me think that on TV they must have a way to make him shut up, to make him stop doing this, because it'd be completely counterproductive on the television. Yeah. Like a taser plugged into his chair or something, and that they hadn't brought it along. And so, but basically what they were doing was, they were doing the stuff that they do on the television. You know, so Gary Neville told us at great length why he thinks Arsenal might now have a chance to win the league. And Jamie Carragher looked at his phone at one point and told us the West Ham Newcastle score and that Frank Lampard had gone back to Chelsea. And, you know, you're doing a show. You're doing a show to, you're not the news, you know. It's a, it's a cardinal sin of the West End stage, you know, telling the audience the scores at the Saturday matinee, because maybe they've come to the matinee because they want to watch Match of the Day, said Derek Jacobi. You know, and they did have some guests. They had Patrice Evra, who, because the room was very, when they asked, you know, are there any Arsenal fans here? Are there any? And people make that sort of lowing noise where each individual is making the noise that they think the crowd makes, you know? Yeah. Are there any Chelsea fans here? And then so many more United fans than anyone else. Yeah. But so Patrice Evra, they got into a nice story about a time when Carragher fouled Nani so hard that he made him cry. Which I think, and it went on for ages, and it's not a clip that Nani should be seeking out on YouTube, I don't think. Roy Keane thinks he's a big baby, let me put it that way. And they had Stuart Pearce, who had the best timing of all of them, and you got the feeling that his stories have been very well road tested on the after dinner circuit, you know, but enjoyable, and the crowd very much on his side. Some Brian Clough stuff, some I used to be a plumber stuff, some England stuff, and they flashed the big picture of his face after he scored in the penalty shootout in Euro 96, you know. And there were it's Gary Neville's overlap podcast thing, I think, but it was very much a Sky deal. And they had some odd film bits which they played on the big screen above, and Gary and Jamie and Roy Keane turned around and watched themselves, you know, doing these things. Yeah. And they seem to be from an upcoming Sky programme, a sort of low rent league of their own, which is a horrible place to pitch yourself, isn't it? But still, so you had the three super pundits watching themselves having a go at being a referee and linesman on Hackney Marshes. And you know, show Roy Keane refereeing and the other two linesmen, that's fine. But then they have swapped around, and then Gary Neville has a go, and then Jamie Carragher has a go. Oh man, on and on it went. And it was about as entertaining as I'm making it sound, I think.
And then really?
if not less. And then a proper referee marked their performances, of course, because all entertainment is judgmental now. You know, and made Jamie Carragher the winner, which was roundly booed in the room. And then they went and did another one, which was very odd. They were in the National Gallery, right? Roy Keane, Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher, looking at some pictures. One was The Execution of Lady Jane Grey by Paul Delaroche. So there. And one of them went, look at the axe on that. And then they looked at a picture of a horse about which they had, you know, not much to say, but they seem to have filmed it that day. I can't remember exactly what it was, but there were one of them said something very topical, so they seem to have filmed it that afternoon. And then when we came back to the arena, to the actual show, they'd set up some easels and given them felt pens.
No!
And they had a minute. Why? They had a minute to do a self-portrait. Hey, guess what music they played for that minute? See if you can.
Painting by numbers.
No.
Paint it black.
No. If only. No. It was, of course, the gallery music from Vision On.
Oh,
which,
yes.
You know, the ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding. You know, and judging by the all the people around me and Simon, my friend who I went with, it must have been an absolutely baffling reference. Thing that hasn't been on for 50 years.
Yeah.
But still. And then, of course, we have, you know, they turn around, we have a look. And, of course, then the crowd get to choose the best one. Now, Gary Neville drew himself in Manchester United kit, complete with an enormous nose, which is very self-aware. But his United kit was so particular. It had the club badge and it had the manufacturer's logo, which made it look like he'd drawn himself nipples, which was very fine. Yeah. And Keane's was like just a big round plate of a face with a smile like a four-year-old might have done. And Carragher's was actually easily the most detailed and had some jokes in it and used several colours. He didn't have time, I guess, to draw in the other car and the spit flying across. But basically, his was easily the most accomplished of a very poor set. But the crowd got to pick the winner, which was Roy Keane's one, of course, and Jamie Carragher's picture got booed.
There
was 20 minutes after the scheduled finish time. Kate said, "We're going to have another quick interval now while the band set up." Okay. At which Simon and I, my friend Simon and I, nodded towards the exit with a single accord. And as we made our way to the car park, it was clear that about half the audience had the same idea and people were streaming away from the arena in all directions. But yeah, it was entertaining enough while it was happening. They were clearly keen to give value for money. If only I'd paid for my ticket, I'd have appreciated that a bit more, maybe. But when you watch the football, these are the guys who come on in the middle or else bang on for hours and hours after when you've already switched off to do something else. Get on with your life. I mean, and they are, for all their many anecdotes and medals and what have you, they're the filler, aren't they? So you're making the filler into a show, into a big show. And when they started, it was like you could feel half the audience battling with a subliminal urge to go and put the kettle on.
Yeah.
No, the halftime entertainment without anything for it to be halftime in. It was like going to a game and finding there was only a bunch of blokes trying to hit the crossbar from the edge of the centre circle, or doing that thing where they put your forehead on a broomstick and you run round making yourself dizzy before trying to take a penalty. Or the sumos getting their own show. Everyone loves the sumos, don't they?
Or going to see the Happy Mondays, but it's only Bez. it's that kind of thing, isn't it? Well, thank you for taking that for the team.
Yeah.
You know, kudos, I have to say. Yeah. I like the idea. I was just thinking about that. You're right about Roy Keane. He always seems slightly baffled that people are amazed by what he's saying because he's just saying what he thinks, and he kind of presumes everybody would think the same thing. I like the idea with the Andy Robertson thing is that he says, "Now I've been watching the player for a few years, and he's a big baby." And I like the idea that he's got every single player written down with one description next to them. You know, I've been watching Ryan Giggs. He's Welsh. Welsh as you like.
I've been watching Harry Kane for years now, and he scores goals. He does.
Goal scorer. We were talking about the Andy Robertson and the referees and all that sort of thing. There was quite a lot of stuff this weekend about Brighton goal disallowed and then a penalty that they should have had, you know, and then an apology from the PGMOL or whatever they're called. Which I found quite interesting.
It seems like they can't help themselves from apologising for Brighton. I think it's the third time they've apologised to Brighton this season. I don't know whether that tells you that Brighton are at a disadvantage generally, but, you know, Konstantin Hatzidakis, the burly linesman, not the only one who's been stood down from officiating.
No.
The VAR from that game, the Spurs-Brighton game, in which... as you say, Brighton had two goals crazily ruled out. I thought the pundits on Match of the Day were quite forgiving about, in a way. I couldn't see why, how you would disallow the Mitoma one that hit him on the shoulder and then he put it in. Yeah. And two definite penalties. Definite penalties turned down. Yeah. And not even checked by the VAR, I think. The second one, the shirt-pulling one. But they got an apology, so that makes it all okay. And that VAR who stood down is refereeing QPR Coventry on Saturday in the Championship. So that's clearly a step down, isn't it, from the VAR? That's a relegation from the VAR, the cushy indoor watching TV job. And Stuart Atwell, the referee who missed the two penalties and bollocksed up the whole game, he's going to be the VAR for Wolves Brentford. So he's been rewarded, hasn't he, paradoxically? He's gone the other way. He's gone...
There's been some talk about the people in the VAR sealed room where it's at Stockton Park, that they, you know, they should be of... the same or a superior level to the referee on the pitch.
Yeah.
But it's a strange relationship, isn't it? Because it just feels that it must be a really difficult thing to pull up your fellow referee professional.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't really... we've spoken about VAR many times, of course, and they still haven't quite worked out what that relationship is and whether it should be a relationship of equals... you know, which is a sort of utopian view of it, isn't it? An idealistic view of it, that there'd be mutual respect and blah, blah, blah. But inevitably, you know, someone's going to be peeved at being pulled up. The on-pitch referee is going to be. And, you know, and part of the reason why they spend quite so long looking at the monitor at the side of the pitch is they're just summoning up, just suppressing the bile before they go out and admit that, you know, someone else thinks they made a mistake. Yeah. I'm not admitting it, but someone else said, you know.
Absolutely. Well, one of the interesting takes on the Brighton game, apart from, by the way, the great De Zerbi Stellini double sending off, which is a good thing. I like to see that.
Well, that was mad, wasn't it? I mean, because De Zerbi was a red card walking from the handshake at the beginning of the game,
wasn't he?
He and Stellini clearly had something in the, you know, had some relationship issue before.
Well, Stellini had said that De Zerbi was just playing Potter's squad, and that he deserved no particular credit, was, I think, the thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, I think De Zerbi could argue that if he was just playing Potter's squad, he should be 11th, you know. But afterwards he was going, oh, I should, it's something to do with respect. You know, I respect everybody, but, you know, I need people to respect me. And they're always banging about respect. Once they've been sent off, it's always about respect, isn't it, somehow?
But and football in general. To tell you this, the moment somebody mentions respect, you know that they have no real idea what respect is.
Yes.
And have no respect for the other person.
They think that respect is their due, whatever they've done or whatever they might do.
Exactly so. But what I found interesting was that I found a big discussion amongst Brighton fans who have decided that this is actually fixing, that this is match fixing, that the Premier League don't want them to be in the top six because it'll ruin the Premier League's coefficient if they don't do well in Europe. Which, of course, is madness.
It is. It's a very complicated conspiracy theory worthy of Donald Trump, I think.
Yes. But on the other hand, I always think that, you know, there must be some underhand stuff going on in football in this country. We always pretend, don't we? You know, it's like when I was growing up, you know, it used to be the best police force and the best, and all of these things, the best legal system, the best this, and all of these things have gradually gone out the window. And you kind of presume, best goalkeepers, that I'm sure there is stuff that goes on.
Well, I think I'd be surprised if there was anything actually corrupt occurring. What I think happens with referees and with VARs, and I've seen, you know, I've noticed the VAR tends to be, you get the feeling that they're subliminal. There's a subliminal thing at work where they're football fans. They watch the football, VAR and the referees. They live and breathe the football, and so they buy into the idea that, for instance, you know, Guardiola is a genius and Manchester City are superior. So you playing a different level of football. And so you see when a City defender hacks someone down in the area, it's almost like they can't believe that it could be what it looks like. Yeah, you know, and I think there are without thinking that they're trying to manipulate the actual league, I think that, you know, when Brighton are playing against Spurs, for instance, what they're playing against are world superstars, and Harry Kane and Son Heung-min and others there are their back page headline makers. They're the players that are picked out on Match of the Day and other TV coverage.
I
think there's a subliminal effect there that referees and VARs tend to give them the benefit of the doubt without maybe even meaning to. Just because of their profile. You know?
And it's impossible. It's impossible for referees to be blind to who the individuals are.
Yeah.
You know, they can't just look at the offence, can they? And they can't. No. And they can't be sort of kept in sort of a hermetically sealed room where they're not allowed to watch any other football or form any other opinions.
They ought to be able to divorce the personality from the offence, if you like. But the players are so recognisable, and they've got their names on the back of their shirts, you know. And they ought to be able to referee it like it's a game of Sabutio and all the players are the same, you know. But they can't. I don't feel like Brighton are being disadvantaged in order to achieve something in the league. But I do feel they're being disadvantaged by not being as well known as the players that they're playing against.
Yeah.
And even though, let it be said, the Brighton's midfielders, Caicedo and McAllister, are likely to cost 70 or 80 million quid.
Absolutely. And just to say that when you say all Sabutio players look the same, I'd just like to say my Stoke City Sabutio team, that George Eastham had one arm and Alan Bloor had one leg. So, you know, they don't look exactly the same, do they? And they didn't come like that, admittedly, but I just
did you have a problem with Adam Bloor then at one point?
I think possibly your sister stood on him, something like that.
Poor Alan.
A few of them had big pools of glue where I'd stuck them back on. Right, we haven't got that much more time, which is great because we keep getting rid of Manchester United and their takeover, and we're going to do exactly that again today and hand it on because it's never going to end anyway.
It's never going to end.
I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a break, and I'm going to leave you with this thought. I think Erling Haaland is going bald.
he's going bald in a strange way from the neck up, isn't he? From behind, and all his hair is on top.
I think he's going bald. I think there's a lot of compensation going on there with the locks moving back. Anyway, you know, it won't necessarily affect his goal scoring, but that's something to ponder during the break.
Anyway, before we tuck into the gold-wrapped chocolate truffle extravaganza that is the Premier League, let us first pick some irritating little bits of tinfoil from last year's cream egg that got sat on and left in the door pocket of the car for a year. I speak metaphorically, of course, of the Vanarama, that most ignorable of leagues that resides below even the dimly lit recesses of League Two. So insignificant are the goings-on at the level where my team, Oldham Athletic, currently ply their trade, if trade is the word I'm looking for. I suspect the part of my phone that auto-corrected it to turd may have been onto something. That the BBC Sport website's Vanarama League table page has been wrong for a good couple of weeks now and nobody has noticed. I think what happened is they just missed out a whole round of results a while back and then carried on updating without realising. So everyone, all the teams, are either 1, 3 or no points different from where they should be, apart from Wealdstone, who've been postponing their games because of their highly water-retentive pitch. So their stats might actually be right because they haven't been playing. But anyway, they should model themselves on the Mudlarks. Do you remember them from the comic?
Oh, yes.
Who could only play in the wet. And they'd always be trailing at half time on some bone dry wreck, and then have to call the fire brigade or something to make it wet enough for them to do their stuff. But anyway, so this casual indifference to the statistical needs of followers of the fifth tier strangely comes at a time when it has never had so much glamour and attention. Wrexham and Notts County had what was billed as the biggest non-league game of all time. on Bank Holiday Monday. Although what could possibly be second on that list escapes me now. Possibly something with Salford in it when the class of 92 were...
Well,
I don't know.
Wrexham last season.
Wrexham Grimsby last season. Yeah, that was a game, wasn't it? But anyway, a proper cracker it was, Wrexham, not Scotty. We'll come to that in a minute. But first, though, let me take you back to Good Friday, the day when we, as a nation, as a people, commemorate Jesus dying to bring us chocolates by mounting a full spread of fixtures, except not the Premier League. Oldham played against Altrincham, once described, as you remember, as the Manchester United of non-league by Tommy Docherty, who'd just taken over as manager and was trying to talk himself out of a deep depression. It was an unimpressive game. Oldham had some chances, scored a couple of rather scruffy goals. By the 79th minute, Altrincham had yet to have a shot on target and then had a man sent off. And I said then to my son, watching the game alongside me, that being down to 10 men was only going to make it more embarrassing when they equalised at the last minute. And that is naturally exactly what happened. How can they not have worked out that pulling everyone back into your own area to defend a corner means that the opposition can throw everyone forwards into the corner as well, into the area as well? Two corners, two goals, with the only two attempts that they had on target. I mean, you know, you have to laugh, as it said on a Oldham flag at a recent game, and one day maybe I will, but... And maybe you will. Who knows? But on to Bank Holiday Monday. And I was set up in my study with the biggest non-league game in history on one screen and Scunthorpe v Oldham, the two teams most recently relegated out of the league, who by rights ought to be the biggest teams in the league.
Just strangely speaking, you've got the two biggest non-league games of all time.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But Wrexham, not Scanty, was a cracker of a game. As I'm sure you had a look at it. End-to-end, thrilling attacking play, terrific goals. Everyone just really going for it, really confident and a sellout crowd and a last-minute penalty save by a former England keeper to clinch the win for Team Hollywood. Meanwhile, on the other screen, what looked like a different sport altogether. I'd realised several times that I'd just not been watching Scunthorpe Oldham. I'd just been watching Wrexham, not Scouty, on the other thing. But Oldham huffed and puffed and banged shins against the Scunthorpe side, who looked like they'd pretty much given up the ghost. They scored a couple of Route 1 goals, Oldham, and that was that. The contrast between the scenes at full time was a stark one. Wrexham celebrated on the pitch with their fans and with their celebrity owners as though promotion was now a done deal, which it isn't quite, I don't think. While the poor Scunthorpe fans were moping around miserably shaking their heads as their team had just been relegated down to the National League North. I mean, it has happened a couple of times before, teams just dropping straight through. Chester did it, I think, and York... Yorker back in the Vanarama now, and Chester maybe coming back finally this time. They're in the playoffs area at the moment. And you had to feel for Scunthorpe. I mean, 5 years ago, they were pushing for the playoffs at the top of League One, and now they're down to Tier Six. And there, but for the grace of God and Frank Rothwell, our flat cap redeemer, go we. Oh. But yeah, so did you watch the Wrexham?
I did do. I feel a bit for Scunthorpe because they've got one of the great nicknames in football, haven't they? The Iron.
The Iron.
I like that, yeah.
Which their commentators use a lot. They use a lot. Corner to the Iron. All that. Yeah. They use it a lot. They're very pleased with it.
I did the same as you. I had Wrexham Notts County on one screen and Birmingham versus Stoke on the other. And I did. I enjoyed the Wrexham game. It's nice to see two teams who both fancy the chances of winning. That always makes it for a better game. That's why I thought that the Arsenal-Liverpool game was such a good game because, you know, for a lot of the game, there wasn't a lot of... There was some time wasting from Arsenal whenever Liverpool got close. But no, yes, I was watching them both. I thought... couple of terrible errors from Notts County, though, to give away goals.
Yeah.
Which, you know, but you expect that. You don't expect the errors, but, you know, they're still playing, whatever way you look at it, they're playing in the Vanarama. You know, there are going to be errors, and that's not being patronising.
But as you say, both teams are so up for it and so going for it that the game inevitably gets stretched and there are plays. There was that, one of the goals was a terrible little cross where he tried to backheel it away, which... Where the Notts County centre-back he could have put it in the stand and tried to do a fancy little...
And the first one, which I was quite pleased, first Wrexham goal was classic defender going down, presuming that he'll get a free kick. And then the ref not giving it, and Mullin went through.
Yeah, well, that's Mullin. Mullin's a beast at this level, isn't he? He's just, I mean, he ought really to have been playing at League One for the last couple of years. But, you know, the fact is Wrexham's players are being paid three or four times the average for the Vanarama. And so, you know, the sooner they go up and bring that average down a bit, the better.
Yeah, the better for everybody else to compete. The only other thing that I noticed, which must have, the linesman missed so many, or gave so many offsides which weren't offside.
Yeah.
He seemed
trigger happy.
He just seemed unable to see monochrome. He was monochrome blind. He couldn't see the Notts County defenders where they were, and they were almost all for Wrexham. And in the meantime, because I was watching them side by side, here was a game where both teams were really going for it. You know, every time it was a free kick, it was a quick free kick. Every time it was a throw, it was a quick throw. Blah 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 blah. And the Stoke game was on at the same time, Stoke v Birmingham, which was really the sort of game only a mother could love. And it was interesting to see that there was more time added on in the Wrexham Notts County game than there was in the Stoke Birmingham game, where it was just a litany of injuries and lying around and going and getting a drink and all of that stuff. And I can only think that the referee was sort of was putting the game out of its misery. It was like a mercy killing.
They do that though, don't they? Sometimes
I think they do. I think that they do mercy time killing. We could call it. now we should really talk about Chelsea, etc. But just very quickly though, Man City were very good in Champions League, I thought.
Yes, they were very good, weren't they? I mean, it's. It was an interesting thing, because apparently Bayern Munich conceded more than one goal for the first time this season, which, you know, Bayern Munich have been so dominant in their own league, and yet they look like big underdogs against City by the end. I mean, they were competing well in the first half, but they just went to bits in the second half.
Well, they did. Well, and especially they failed to score, hadn't they? Well, clearly they failed to score the whole way through the game, but they looked dangerous for a brief time, and then it ended. Did you?
Yeah, Musiala looked dangerous for a bit.
Yeah, did you see that Mane clocked Sané after the game?
Yeah, I did see that. I mean, apparently... you know, it was an argument over which one of them came off worse in a limerick.
Really? Oh, well, I was thinking, Mane, Sané, unhappy days. Sané, Mane, unhappy days.
No, no, yes, it ended, but picking them both is in Sané.
Anyway, so yeah, we should just mention that. And then, and Chelsea, though, that was... They just seemed like they were allergic to the penalty area.
They've been a strange watch for that. I mean, because they haven't scored now for four games in a row, and only two of those are under Frank Lampard. And Lampard was apparently grumbling because Potter hadn't put Aubameyang in the fridge squad. In the fridge, yeah. In his own locker. But then he didn't have a strike, because, you know, he didn't pick Havertz. He had Sterling up front. He didn't pick Havertz, who is has been having a woeful time. And Havertz came on, didn't he? And just everything he did went wrong once he came on.
And João Felix was just anonymous, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, you know, he's... Yeah, I mean, Chelsea are... so much less than the sum of their parts, aren't they? That's the thing with them. And you can see individually they're doing good things. They're doing skillful things. They actually, you know, subdued Real Madrid for quite long periods and did. But Real Madrid always looked like they had another goal in them. But Chelsea were living with them, but just didn't look like scoring against them or beating them.
They had that one chance in there with Sterling and the defender sort of hit the ball together and Courtois made a good save.
Yeah, they had a couple of chances very early on where they broke over the Real Madrid back line, broke through the high line. And Real Madrid just changed how they set up, and that wasn't available anymore after the first couple of minutes, after that Sterling chance and another one. There was another one where a Chelsea player was through and it was saved. by Courtois. Yeah. But then they just slammed that door shut. They saw it happening and slammed that shut. Mm-hmm. But one of the most interesting things about the Chelsea game this midweek was Todd Bowley saying that Chelsea is going to win 3-0.
Yes, I saw
and,
that.
You know, always, and that's always a very bad sign for me when a newbie to the game, you know, for an American to the game. It's like there's those Americans we saw in the World Cup describing a shot that hits the bar as a pole shot. You know, yeah. He says Chelsea is going to win 3-0. And you don't say Chelsea is when you're talking about the team. You know, Chelsea, the club is. Chelsea, the team, are going to win 3-0. Do you know what I mean? And it's jarring to me. And it just highlights how little awareness Todd Bowley has of what he's got himself into.
Well, it was quite an interesting interview with Calderon, who was the ex-president of Real Madrid before Perez, is it? Or is Perez at Barcelona? I'd never remember. But Calderon was the one who brought together the Galacticos and they went 3 years without winning anything at all. And he was saying that, you know, you can't just buy all the players and expect it to work. And he also said that you have to know something about football. He was very critical about US investment in general, actually. He said, you know, it isn't like running a business. It's about people. It's about this sort of strange alchemy that people always talk about in football when things come right. And that same alchemy, that same hope for something magic is what presumably brought Lampard back, although I still can't see it.
But. Yeah, no, it's curious, isn't it? I mean, there seems to be a real fashion currently for the interim boss. You know, I don't know why. Maybe it's the example of the career of Liz Truss has made everything seem possible. But there have been, you know, there have always been interim bosses in a way. The first one I could remember when I was thinking was Joe Mercer, remember, who made a decent fist. Exciting games between Sir Alf Ramsey and the never-knighted Don Revy. Back in the 70s, you know.
Yeah, well, I'd go for Jimmy Armfield also when Clough got sacked, who ended up taking them. There's another one who ended up getting the European Cup final.
Yeah, but he was in charge for 4 years. You know, the phenomenon that seems to be ever more prevalent now is an interim boss who's not like the coach who, you know, because Spurs were talking about, weren't they, giving Stellini the job until the end of the season, and he'd be an interim boss. He was Conte's assistant. Mason would be an interim boss. He was on the coaching staff.
So like Steve Keane at Blackburn or somebody like that.
Yeah,
Or that guy Parks.
Tony Parks.
Blackburn
He was always stepping in, wasn't he? But now they seem to go for a proper, fully fledged, Dean Smith going in at Leicester and Frank Lampard going back to Chelsea. And, you know, you feel like with an interim boss like that, the pressure is the chance to show the new owners that you could do the job full time. You know, now he's had another year of experience, not very good experience at Everton since they sacked him before. And it was the different regime that sacked him. So maybe he could step up if he could ever get them to score a goal. I mean, my worry about Frank Lampard is that he's going to go full Benjamin Button. You know, he's going to go back to Derby and then go back to playing again.
Then go back to playing,
Split up with Christine Bleakley, back to the academy at West Ham, and then on his way to becoming a fetus in scenes that nobody wants to see, especially not Mrs. Frank Lampard Sr. But Dean Smith is someone who's been on the market for a proper job as opposed to an interim job, and has a good CV, but. You know,
Dean Smith is. It reminds me when we got rid of Mark Hughes the year we went down.
Yeah.
We were casting around for a manager, and we ended up appointing Paul Lambert. Yeah. And I think the thing is that there are certain times when it's very difficult to get the right sort of manager, and so this appointment of an interim, so rather than, you know, you're here, we're going to build everything around you. It's more we're hoping you can do something, but we're probably going to get rid of you at the end of the season. And I just. It is a strange, and as you say, it does increasingly happen. You know that.
Well, there's one at Hearts. Stephen Naismith has gone in at Hearts.
That's right.
Who sacked Robbie Nielsen, who's been there for quite a while, when they dropped into fourth place because, according to the chief executive Andrew McKinley, Hearts should be third. Yeah. And you know, but drop to fourth, sack the manager. I mean, you wonder, don't you, what the owners, like our friend Rob and the fan group, feel about that one? If they were consulted, or whether they were distracted by the vote on the new third kit.
Yes, indeed. Or the renaming of the bar. One of the funny stories that came out was that supposedly Bowley had been convinced to appoint Lampard by James Corden, who had befriended Bowley, and being a West Ham fan, was an admirer of Lampard, and had suggested him. Now, of course, there's no way of knowing if that's true. It's a lovely idea that you know, the final decision should come down to some sort of comic celebrity.
Yeah. Well,
Michael McIntyre was in charge of Antonio Conte going to Spurs, and that Jack Tatti got Jean Tigana, the Fulham job.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because I've spoken to a couple of West Ham fans who are friends of mine, and actually Mark Webster, when we were talking to the other week as well. I think may have said this in the show, that there's not a great deal of affection for Frank Lampard Jr. at West Ham, because there's an element of him having left them in the lurch, of him having betrayed them and gone to Chelsea. So maybe, you know, maybe Corden's playing a complicated double game, which would be so like him.
Yeah, absolutely right. And of course, there's a difference between an interim manager, I think, and a caretaker manager.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I get the impression that the caretaker then goes back to his job.
Back to the sweeping and
The Roy Evans
cleaning the toilets.
Joe Fagan type person that goes back into the boot room, whereas an interim manager is there for a short period of time and maybe will be considered later on.
Well, the interim manager, the point of the interim manager is only banking everything on new manager bounce. That's all they offer. Isn't it? If you're not giving them a job beyond the summer, what they offer is, because clubs that are in trouble or struggling, they have two options, don't they? They can stick or they can twist. And it's hard not to think that Chelsea should have stuck with Graham Potter, for me. It's hard not to think that Leicester would be better off having stuck with Brendan Rodgers. And the one that that breaks that particular run is Vieira at Palace. And you think, oh, they should have stuck with Patrick Vieira, because all the story since he took over there seems to be that he was doing well, he was building something, blah, blah, blah. And then Hodgson comes in and they're a different team, just a different team. Yeah. Did you watch the second half, anyway, of the Leeds game? And they were just purring, Crystal Palace. It was amazing to watch. And they hadn't apparently won a game without Wilfried Zaha in the team all season. I think they'd lost all eight when he'd not been playing. And he wasn't playing. And Eze and Michael Olise just ran the game. Just incredible.
Eze, I think, is an exceptional player. He's been out quite a lot.
I think Olise is a fantastic... Olise's two assists. They were simple passes, but just perfectly weighted, just perfectly into the stride of the for Eze to score the one under the keeper. And I think Eze and Olise, they have two fantastic players who haven't maybe been getting a game because of it's two out of three when Zaha is fit, you know.
Yeah. Well, and staying on the managerial merry-go-round, which, by the way, is going at such a fucking pace at the moment, nobody should be allowed on it, I don't think. And I've no great love for Paul Ince, but I thought his sacking was particularly unfair because it was down to the organisers of the club. It's down to the chief executive officer or whoever that they had 6 points taken off them, which then pushed them down the league, and then he gets sacked because they're further down the league.
Yeah, they're in the bottom three. Well, Reading should be, you know, 21st. Yeah. That's the chief executive said. And, you know, as you say, it's not Paul Ince's fault. I mean, didn't Paul Ince... Oh, he's had a very difficult job there because they so overspent Reading, didn't they? Weren't they the club that spent 140% of their turnover on transfers and wages, and so far ahead of what they're allowed by financial, not financial fair play anymore, it's called profitability and sustainability, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this 6-point deduction is suspended from last year, where they were deducted 6 points and told it'd be six more if they did it again, and they have done it again. So it's not really down to Paul Ince that they're in the bottom three, I don't think. But still,
no. And anyway, just on that whole thing, I like the idea that it was a time where you had an impact sub, and then you have impact players, and then you had impact managers, impact coaches, impact directors of football, CEOs, owners. It's just all moved on from what actually happened on the pitch.
Yeah. Do you think there's a case for Manchester United appointing interim owners until the end of the season?
That's not a bad idea. And, you know, funny enough, even Scaloni, who won the World Cup with Argentina, was a substitute manager. And Scolari when Brazil won it.
Yeah, and Zagallo in 70 as well, I think, had only just taken
It's an observable phenomenon. And I've a feeling, Chris, that Gareth Southgate was an interim England manager, wasn't he?
He was, yes, before he got the job properly, because he stepped in after the Allardyce messed the bed, didn't he, with some sort of press offering something to a journalist.
After he'd played one game.
And he played one game and won one game, so we'll forever have the 100% England manager record, thanks to Adam Lallana. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm definitely going to be pointing both of my children in the direction of interim jobs, because that's clearly where the future is. And to tell you the truth, I think that's probably the limit of what they can expect. And we should finish now. But in all of this, one of the things I found most bizarre, of course, I don't know, because I don't support them and I don't go there, but the hatred at Aston Villa for Steven Gerrard, just because they're doing so well now, is staggering. Absolutely hated. So we'll maybe revisit that next week.
Well, that was the chapter in Dean Smith's career as well, wasn't it? Because they sacked Dean Smith. I think he'd had five bad results in a row, but it felt like at that time they should have stuck with him because he was doing okay. But then Steven Gerrard became available, and they were worried someone else was going to get him.
Yeah. And in the meantime, Steven Gerrard's second in command, Beale, went from QPR, leaving them at top, and since then they're in the relegation places too.
And he's at Rangers now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's at Rangers now. That's the managerial merry-go-round for. That's the managerial merry-go-round for you. Right, we'll see you next week, hopefully. That was about football, Chris, wasn't it?
Quite a lot of that.
I suppose that's the idea.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.